This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
I'm joined by Dan Gross, who is a radical labor lawyer by training, who was once a co-founder of the Starbucks Workers Union, and is currently the executive director of Brand Workers International. He is also the co-author with Stoughton Lind of Labor Law for the Rank and Filer, which we're going to be talking about, and you can receive a free copy with your new or renewed membership with KBOO. Thanks for joining us, Dan.
Good to be with you, Joe.
So I mentioned just a couple things, but could you speak a bit more about your background with labor law and workplace organizing?
Absolutely. You know, I got into this work actually while I was working at Borders Books and Music. I was a bookseller there. I had had bad jobs before then, but never at a multinational corporation. My coworkers and I, as you might imagine, I faced low wages and disrespectful management and very insecure schedules. And I reached out and tried to figure out what one did when confronted with that kind of issue at work, and really didn't know where to turn, and reached out to a bunch of places. I only heard back from one group, and that was the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World. That was well over 10 years ago, and I'm proud to be with the union all these years later.
Labor Law for the Rank and Filer is a little over 100-page book. It fits in your pocket. You've got a lot of great information about the most relevant labor laws and the major cases interpreting them. What are you and Stoughton Lind getting at when you say building solidarity while staying clear of the law?
What Labor Law for the Rank and Filer seeks to do is articulate legal knowledge and legal rights practice based on a wholly different kind of unionism from what we know as the traditional union model today of representation and exclusive collective bargaining agency. What Stott and I are attempting to do is promote a kind of unionism that I'll describe as a member-led and operated, a union where it's your coworkers on the shop floor that do the heavy lifting of organizing and research and strategy and coming up with direct action plans that win. So what Labor Law for the Rank and Filer attempts to do is give workers the legal toolkit that they'll need to pursue this different kind of unionism. I think looking at our country today, the central issue facing us working people is the outsized role of corporate power in our political, economic, and social life, and the singular failure of the traditional labor movement to fight back and win. You know, 6.6% of workers in the private sector are in traditional labor organizations. So over 93 out of 100 have no representation to speak of. So what Stoughton and I think is that the next big wave of worker organizing and action and mass struggle is going to come from a very fundamentally different model, what Stoughton has coined solidarity unionism, a type of unionism with three basic tenets. One, it's rank and file led and operated, as I said. That's the most important tenet. Two, the unity in a solidarity union is just that. It's solidarity. It's not compelled membership. It's not a situation where, well, you get hired at a job and, you know, there you are. You're pushed into a labor organization, whether you like it or not. It's a unionism based on everyday solidarity, unity between workers that's voluntary. And finally, a unionism powered by direct action, not by bargaining or public relations, which is a big element of the traditional union world today, or political advocacy, but action on the job, in the community, taken by workers themselves. It's happening all over the country in very different contexts. Workers through necessity, by trying to find something that works, that's effective, that makes sense, that feels real, are turning to this member-led, member-operated unionism, united by solidarity and powered by direct action. And Labor Law for the Rank and Filer is the legal toolkit of how to do it.
I want to return back to the theme of labor law in this book. All too often, unions and workplace organizing are dismissed as throwbacks to a relatively barbaric era because people claim that labor laws like those prohibiting child labor perform the same functions that unions are pretending to provide today. What function have labor laws been created to serve historically, and what has that meant for working class organizing?
What Stoughton and I argue in Labor Law for the Rank and Filer is that law is, at best, a tangential tool that in limited cases can be useful both as a sword and as a shield. So with respect to being able to offensively use the law, we've seen especially immigrant workers using minimum wage and overtime cases to bring to bear an additional pressure element against an employer opponent. We've seen workers in the context of broader direct action strategies use unfair labor practice charges as a defensive shield. But most importantly, what Staten and I are trying to help workers do is understand the contours of the law and how the law serves both as a repressive net and seeks to take away some of workers' most powerful weapons, like striking in solidarity with a coworker at another company, and also the co-opting nature of the law. And I think that, Joe, is the most insidious part of labor law today, this process by which you seek either government certification or so-called voluntary employer recognition to create what is at bottom a bureaucratic labor organization, an organization where workers themselves actually lose the right to take action on their own and figure out problems with their coworkers. Staunton and I think that unionism needs to actually get back to where it was in the early 20th century. We call solidarity unionism the road not taken by labor, but, you know, there's just such a rich history. You know, this year we're celebrating the 100th anniversary of Local 8 of the IWW, the storied union of dock workers, African-American workers, Irish immigrant workers, Eastern European workers, native-born white workers, who dominated the ports of Philadelphia through everyday solidarity and everyday direct action. They didn't enter into contract with employers that divorced workers from their rights. They controlled the workplace every day.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking with Dan Gross, co-author of Labor Law for the Rank and Filer. We are now going to go to Ani and Liz. They will be telling you about how you can get a free copy of Labor Law for the Rank and Filer with your new or renewing membership.
That's right, Joe. My name is Liz, and I'm here with Ani. Say good morning,
good
Ani.
Good morning.
And we're here to interrupt the Old Mole for just a moment to ask you to support this program and all of the other great public affairs and news programs that you hear on KABU by going to your phone and calling 1-877-500-5266 or go online at KBOO.FM. Click on the Donate Now jar up in the upper right-hand corner. Become a member of your public radio station. Ani, what do we have to say about that?
Well, it's my pleasure to be here this morning bringing support in for the Old Mole Variety Hour. It is a phenomenal show. It's here every week, bringing you voices of the working class, bringing you analysis, sociological analysis that is accessible, that actually helps to explain the world around us so that we can find common footing together and we can make progress together. The Old Mole's working away underground so that they can, in fact, take down that this oppressive system we find ourselves in, and it's very much an act of solidarity. That is what is talked about every week on the Old Mole Variety Hour. It's a great public affairs show. You're listening right now, so you know the value it brings to your mind and your life. Now it's time to put a little financial backing to that value and help to support KABU Community Radio so that we can remain strong and independent, bringing you voices just like those you hear every Monday morning on the Old Mole. Joe and Tom and Clayton and Bill and so many others, Denise and Jan and Fran, Lori, all these people working together to bring you this amazing, well-produced public affairs program, talking about labor, talking about the working class, talking about things that matter to us. And again, Labor Law for the Rank and Filer, you're listening to the interview right now, and that is a gift that can be yours. We want to say thank you by giving you a copy of Labor Law for the Rank and Filer. It's yours for a $60 contribution this morning. You can do that just $5 a month when you call 877-500-5266 and talk with the phone answerer about setting up a monthly electronic funds transfer. You can do that for $5 a month or $7 a month, $10 a month. Whatever you can work into a monthly budget would be fabulous. We would love that kind of support, and we really want your participation. Give us a call at 877-500-5266 or online. You can donate at kboo.fm. If you're listening to this interview right now, go ahead, give us a call at that $60 level, join KABU, and get the gift of Labor Law for the Rank and Filer. It can be yours, limited copies though, so you want to get on that quickly. 877-500-5266.
Thanks, Ani. And Liz, we're now going to be going back to me talking with Dan Gross. One of the interesting things that you and Staunton treat early on in the book is just where workers' rights come from and kind of the misconceptions or misnomers about what workplace rights have in relation to our broader idea of rights. And I was wondering if you could tell us, where do workers' rights come from in this country?
labor law came around mid-1930s in the United States, the Wagner Act, the landmark law in this area, the National Labor Relations Act, to really legitimize unions in terms of giving them a piece of some bureaucratic space where workers supposedly through their representatives would have a seat at the table, and capital, the big corporations would accept that, and government would accept that. I don't think employers ever truly embraced that model. I think they accepted it because they had to at the time. Unions, though, I think felt that, wow, here we are, you know, we've arrived. We're a powerful force in the economy and politics in the society. Come the late 70s, early 80s, companies and their agents and government saw that conditions had ripened for them to undo that social compact, if you will, and go for the jugular. And unions to this day still haven't responded. The ideas out there to, you know, rev up the labor movement, they're all good. I would call them best practices. Things like allocating more budget to organizing, doing deeper research, using data better. You know, none of them are bad ideas. They're best practices, sure. Why not? But what's facing the labor movement today is much more dramatic than that. And that's what I really, although I respect many of the people putting forward these ideas and I've been influenced and impacted by them, I think they're missing the point. The real problem we have to get at, if workers are going to come together in mass numbers, fight and win, it is member-led and member-operated nature of unionism has been completely lost in the traditional model today, where the idea is get yourself into an institution that'll negotiate for you, that'll bargain for you, that'll be your exclusive representative, in fact, and that word exclusive is very important. No one else can represent you, including yourself, because you have an exclusive bargaining agent. So for your technical listeners, what Staunton and I are arguing is that workers ought to look at Section 7 and Section 8 of the National Labor Relations Act. That's the right to come together and organize without regard to having a traditional union or not. That means you and your coworkers sticking up for each other without any, you know, filing with the government, anything like that. Receive protection. Section 8 gives you a right to file charges against an employer. Oh, that right is very flawed, but it's one tool in a broader toolkit. And we're cautioning workers to get involved in Section 9. That's the certification section that gets you into this exclusive collective bargaining arrangement that Staunton and I are very critical of. There's just too much what economists call agency costs. The cost of having others represent your interests, we just think, are ultimately overcome by any benefit that might come for that arrangement. It's so exciting to see solidarity unionism out there in action. The Starbucks Workers Union, I think, has been hugely influential. Many have commented recently that the upsurge in union fights in fast food and big box retail has been deeply influenced by the effort of those baristas out there, you know, with very little financial resources coming together and through these tools in labor law for the rank and file, fighting and winning big.
Well, that's all the time we have, Dan. I've been talking with Dan Gross, Executive Director of Brand Workers International, but also the co-author with Staunton Lynn of Labor Law for the Rank and Filer. If you call in before the end of the show, you can get a free copy with your renewing or new membership. Thanks for joining us, Dan.
It's been good talking, Jill.
You law-abiding citizens, listen to this song. Laws were made by people, and people can be wrong. Once unions were against the law, but slavery was fine. Women were denied the vote and children worked the mine. The more you study history, the less you can deny it. A rotten law stays on the books till folks with guts defy it. Have you been to jail for justice? I won't shake your hand. Sitting in and lying down are ways to take a stand. Have you sung a song for freedom or marched that picket line? Have you been to jail for justice? Oh, you're a friend of mine.
You are tuned to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Joe Clement, your host and engineer for the hour. I was just talking with Daniel Gross, one of the co-authors with Staunton Lynn, of a great little book that we have as a membership gift called Labor Law for the Rank and Filer. I'm now going to turn back to Ani and Liz, who are going to tell you about why you should donate to this great institution, this worker-led and operated institution.
There are so many reasons, Joe. So many reasons. This is Ani. I'm here with Liz, and it is our spring membership drive here at KABU. There are many reasons to join this institution that is, in fact, funded by you, community members, and driven by volunteers. There's a small paid staff, and we all work together to bring you community radio that supports everyone, that brings us together, that informs us and inspires us so we can take right action in our lives. I've been really loving the discussion on labor law for the rank and filer this morning, Joe. Again, we do have copies of that book for your $60 minimum contribution to KABU this morning. We would love to say thank you by giving you a copy of that book. And you would be one of those people helping us reach an $800 goal we have for the Old Mole Variety Hour. And we can reach that goal again. It's that collective action thing. We need to thank so many people when you call 877-500-5266 and let us know that you're there, you're listening, you're in our community with your ears, and you're also willing to back that community with a little financial support so that we can remain strong and independent together. 877-500-5266 or online, kboo.fm.
That's right, Ani. You know, and we do have a lot of people to thank, all the people who've become members so far during our membership drive. And particularly this morning, thanks to James renewing his membership in Salem. Way to go, Salem. Represent. Let's hear from some of the outer boroughs. How about Aloha? How about Forest Grove? Beaverton? Boring? Estacada?
What about Vancouver?
Vancouver, the Couve, Camas, Battleground, Hood River, all those places. We need to hear from you. We know that you listen to this program. We know that you think it's important because you're with us right now. Show your support. Pick up that phone, 1-877-500-5266. That's 500-KBOO. How cool is that? That our phone number matches our call letters. I mean, come on, this is great, you know?
It's almost like we planned it,
you know? And as Ani mentioned, we do have this terrific thank you gift that ties right in with what you're discussing today, the book, Labor Law for the Rank and Filer. And that can be yours for just a $60 membership. $60 is a lot of money up front, but, you know, you can do it as a monthly electronic funds transfer, just $5 a month. It's a safe, secure way to support the station in a sustaining manner. And our intrepid phone volunteers are waiting to take your call. But we need to hear from you right now. Put down that cup of coffee. Pull over to the side of the road if you're on the road, because we don't want you to talk and drive and get in an accident. But pick up that phone right now, 877-500-5266. And if you think we're not talking to you, we are, in fact, talking directly to you, because 83% of our funding, 83% comes from individual listeners just like you. You with your morning paper, you driving to work, you putting your kids into preschool, you cleaning your house, you going out into your garden, whatever it is that you're doing this morning, you are part of that 83%. Won't you show your support for this station? You know, there's a passive thing about listening. Listening is something that you just kind of do. It happens to you. But you can become an active member. Stop passive listening. Become an active member. 877-500-5266. Or if you know you're more wired in, go to our website, kboo.fm. Click on the Donate Now jar up in the upper right-hand corner. Show your support for the amazing programming that you hear every Monday on the Old Mole Variety Hour and all of the other great news and public affairs that you will only get at KABU. Ani?
It's so true. And this morning has been a great morning for workers. You know, listening to more talk radio and listening to the whole the state of organized labor, busting myths about unions, and how, in fact, unions really do work to protect workers and make us stronger together. We're hearing more of that now in the Old Mole. It's, you know, KABU is there to support, and we need your support back. It is one of those mutually symbiotic relationships. 877-500-5266 or online at kboo.fm. I want to thank Katie O'Brien's at 2809 Northeast Sandy Boulevard, Pasta Works at 3735 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard, and Namaste at 8303 Northeast Sandy Boulevard. These folks are keeping the volunteers fed today, and now we need you to keep the radio station fed, and that is with just a little bit of your hard-earned money. Consider giving 1 hour's wage every month. If you do that, you would be a sustaining member. We would love that support. We would love your participation. And it's so easy easy to do. It's a way that it kind of averages things out across our membership base. So if you make $10 an hour, call in with a $10 a month contribution to your community radio station. I myself, you know, I contribute a little bit more than that as somebody who's worked at KBOO now for, I don't know, 13 years. You know, I give something more like $14 a month. And that's because, you know, it's a way that we can stretch that around, spread that around to each other and support the entire community. I think it evens things out. Many hands make light work, and you can do your part at a rate that feels comfortable and good to you. 877-500-5266 or online at kboo.fm.
Thanks, Ani and Liz. Well, up next, Bill Resnick, our senior analyst, is going to be talking with Gwen Sullivan of the Portland Association of Teachers about high-stakes testing and where it comes from and really why it's not about and why our opposition to it is not a opposition to education, but is really a fight for education.
Gwen Sullivan, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you so much for having me.
Gwen Sullivan is the president of the Portland Association of Teachers. Like teachers' unions all over this country, they're under attack from business interests and the politicians who are pushing particularly high-stakes testing. Gwen Sullivan, the teachers' unions are trying to point out that high-stakes testing is a terrible idea. How do you make those points? How do you argue here?
So, Bill, it's really important to know that PAT really strongly supports educating kids. And we don't believe that teaching to a test and the testing regime that is happening all over this country is about really educating our kids. And so if we're really going to educate our kids, then this is certainly not the way, through high stakes testing. I have to say that one thing that these tests do not do is they don't test critical thinking. They don't test problem solving. They don't test how people work together cooperatively in groups. They really test just simple facts that are to be regurgitated for a certain amount of time. So you have to make sure that kids are just prepared for certain facts. And they're confusing. So they don't actually always test what you are hoping that they are, that they should test.
Also, it seems to me it really degrades teaching. In some ways, it's just obviously just easier. You just have this set of things that you tell kids and then ask them to repeat after you. It's all written down there. Teachers are actually freed from having to prepare, having to think, having to tailor a curriculum for the kids you have, but it degrades teaching.
Teachers being widgets, and yeah. I would say that, so it does degrade teaching, and we hold our profession and with a really high standard. And I think that it is really important to be able to understand what assessing kids really looks like, that there are many ways to assess kids, and it is through constantly monitoring kids' actions, their knowledge, and then that helps you change your instruction, modify your instruction, getting them to demonstrate their knowledge, having them really dive in and do research and argue certain points is much more meaningful. So there are many ways that we really want to educate kids, and it does pull away from what we believe, because every child is different and they come in with different characteristics, different knowledge, different backgrounds. And in order to do that, we need to make sure that we're constantly changing and modifying our instruction. And these high-stakes tests do not do that.
One other thing about this high-stakes test is it's a bonanza for these companies who create them and prepare them and charge enormous amounts of money for them. It really is a huge national ripoff of the school systems. And these companies actually are part of the apparatus, that is the testing companies, the publishing companies, the people who create these standard curriculums and charge for every student every year to get their worksheets. It's just an enormous corrupt, seems predatory effort by them, and successful.
Yes. Originally, the OAKS test was developed by Oregon educators, and it was developed to get a baseline information of a group of students. It was never intended to evaluate individual students, never intended to evaluate individual schools. It was just to get some baseline information. And now we're going to be moving into a different assessment that talk about money. The amount of money spent on the individual test is enormous, But then you think about all the time and energy that will be put into just prepping kids for these tests. So we won't be educating kids about what we know is best for them, for their learning. We're actually going to be spending much more time making sure they're prepared for the test. And that takes valuable time away from teaching and learning.
And for the kids, instead of reading interesting stuff, instead of investigating interesting things, instead of even playing together in games that require some kind of intellectual effort, they're studying how to fool examiners on multiple choice tests to always keep performing correctly, that is, giving them the right answers.
You know, I think about my own students that I've had. I think that these tests truly measure poverty, and they don't honestly measure what you want them to. I think about this one particular kid that said to me, "Can you please help me? Can you please help me?" And of course, when you're doing these testing, you can't help the kids. You're not allowed to even help them with their testing. And finally, I went over and I said, "What seems to be the problem?" And he said, "I don't know what this word is." Now, this was a math problem, and the word was garage, about how could this car fit into the garage. Well, why would this kid know what a garage is when he's only lived in apartments and shelters? So what is it really measuring, the math or this child's poverty?
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour talking to Gwen Sullivan. Gwen's a longtime teacher, now president of the Portland Association of Teachers. Gwen, what's happening? There's resistance to this high-stakes testing. It's not making the media, but it certainly is happening in every school district around the country. And in some places, and even some states are now deciding not to cooperate in the high-stakes testing regime. School boards recognize the huge cost. Tell us about that and what's happening in Oregon.
So you're absolutely right. It is happening all over the country that school districts, school boards, and even some states are really opting out of these high-stakes testing. Here in Oregon, there have been students that have called attention to pulling out of these, trying to encourage kids and their parents to opt out of this high-stakes testing. And I have to tell you, myself as a parent, I have two kids in Portland Public Schools, and I have opted my kids out of the test. And I just think, if I wouldn't want this for my children, why would I want this for anyone's children? So the movement is growing, and I hope it continues, and maybe that will send a message to the feds and to the state about what is really important to our schools.
You know, one final thing. Tell us about Rudy Crewe and his recent statements about testing. It was just absurd. Rudy is
the chief education officer for the state of Oregon, I believe, something like that. He recently stated that this testing mania is out of control, that there's way too much emphasis on it. Yet he also said, but this is what the feds are requiring us to do. So this is how it is, folks, that even though he thinks that we're moving in the wrong direction with testing, these are the requirements. And we stand up for what's right. We should be saying, no, if these aren't good for kids, then we're not going to be doing this.
Gwen Sullivan, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Thank you, Bill.
Each box that you mark on each test that you take, remember your teachers, their jobs are at stake. Your score is their score, but don't get all stressed. They never teach anything not on the test. The school board is faced with no child left behind. With rules but no funding, they're caught in a bind. So music and art and the things you love best are not in your school, 'cause they're not on the test. Sleep, sleep, and as you progress, you'll learn there's a lot that is not on the test.
You are tuned to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host, Joe Clement. I would like to tell you about a special event that KBOO will be participating in at the Hollywood Bowl this next Saturday, the 6th, from 9 a.m. the whole day, from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. We're going to be airing KBOO from the Hollywood Bowl. We're going to be giving tickets away from this, and if you call 503-231 8032. Our lovely receptionist, Sam, will inform you of how you get tickets. Before we go on to the last interview about between Denise Morris and Matilda Bernstein Sycamore, I'd like to turn it back over to Ani and Liz Schwartz to tell you about why you should support KABU.
Well, why should you support KABU? You know, let me count the ways.
There are so many.
My name is Liz, and I'm here with Ani. We're both volunteers at KABU, but Ani is also staff.
I walk in two worlds. It's true.
It's amazing. But every voice you hear on the air at KABU is somebody volunteering their time, including the two of us. And we know that you appreciate the value of having volunteers come in and bring you all this kind of unique programming, like the Old Mole Variety Show. But, you know, we need for you to show your support for that kind of programming by picking up your phone and calling 1-877-500-5266. That's toll-free all over the country. It is safe. It is secure. And we need to hear from you. Our volunteers are standing by to take your call. But if you prefer to reach us electronically, you can go to kboo.fm. Click on the Donate Now jar in the upper right-hand corner. It looks like a pickle jar. And become a member that way.
I love pickles.
Pickles are great, you know. And we have so many people to thank who've already become members of the station. Don't we, Ani?
We do. We want to thank Carolyn for renewing in Portland. We want to thank Jackie for renewing in Portland. I do believe Carolyn is standing behind me. She's walked in.
Carolyn came in. That's another way that you can show your support. You know, you can come visit us at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. We're just between Burnside and Ankeny, across from the Imago Theater, next to the Jupiter Hotel in inner Southeast Portland. You can come in and bring us your donation in person. We love to meet our donors and people who become members of our KABU community that way. So if you've got some extra time today,
come on,
stop on by. We'll give you a tour of the station. We'll introduce you to your favorite hosts.
Beautiful scenic
we'll
Southeast.
We'll give you a hug.
8th Street Avenue. You know, it's on your way to anywhere.
Yeah.
And here we are, your local community radio station. Doors are open. Come on in, take a tour of the station, see how your money is put to use here to make great radio for the entire community. We need to raise about another $660 this morning. And again, we can do that with your help. One at a time, everyone working together. It really can happen. It's transformative. 877-500-5266. And you know what I've noticed, Liz?
What?
If folks call this morning, they'll be talking to a public affairs host because our entire phone answering staff are made up of delightful public affairs hosts.
It's true.
It's true. There they are.
Wow.
Waiting to take your call and talk to you. You could probably even engage them in some sort of dialectic material rationalism. 877-500-5266. Call in now with your membership. Support KABU during our spring membership drive. We do need to hear from you. We need to raise $600 before 10 o'clock, and with your help, all things are possible. 877-500-5266 or online at kboo.fm.
You know, $600 is just 10 people becoming members at the $60 level, and if you do that right now, you can also pick up a copy of Labor Law for the Rank and Filer. But we need to hear from you right now. 1-877-500-KBOO. Thanks.
Thank you, Liz and Ani. Well, you're tuned to the Old Mole Variety Hour. We've talked with Matilda Bernstein Sycamore before on the show. She's a Seattle-based author and activist. She's written two novels, including So Many Ways to Sleep Badly, and is the editor of several nonfiction anthologies, most recently, and what you may have heard us talk with her about on The Old Mole, called Why Are Faggots So Afraid of Faggots? Flaming Challenges to Masculinity, Objectification, and the Desire to Conform. She joins Old Mole Denise Morris again this morning to discuss her newly published The End of San Francisco. It's described as part memoir, part social history, and part elegy. The End of San Francisco explores the dream of a radical queer community and the mythical city that was supposed to nurture it.
Thanks, Joe. Matilda Bernstein Sycamore, thank you for joining us at KABU. The End of San Francisco is described as, quote, breaking apart the conventions of memoir. It's part memoir, part social history, and part elegy. Talk about the style and structure of the book.
Well, I think that most memoirs have the uncanny ability to take the most fascinating, multifaceted, complicated lives and package them into this neat, tidy, linear structure. You know, that sort of goes from point A to point Z. And for me, that actually takes away the impact of the book. You know, I think my life, for example, and I think most lives, they don't go from point A to point Z. You know, maybe when I'm dead and buried in the ground, you can fly over with a helicopter and plot everything out like that. But until then, everything will always be all at once. And so for me, in writing this book, you know, and choosing to call it memoir, I wanted to resist that conventional packaging that takes away the power, the intimacy, the intensity, the confusion, the beauty, the struggle, the complications. And instead, The End of San Francisco, you know, it's called The End of San Francisco, and at times you're wondering, is this book even about San Francisco? Or, you know, it starts in a much later place than it ends. You know, it ends kind of in childhood, and, you know, it starts more in the near past. And so for me, I really wanted to resist that conventional structure in order to present something more open, more honest, more intimate, and ultimately, I think, more revealing.
When your writing has really walked the line between fiction and nonfiction, and you have resisted autobiography, stating that, you know, it is the past as all lies, you also said of The End of San Francisco that, quote, I want the reader to experience the process I went through, and this is part of the intimacy. And it is structured, as you say, by emotion.
Exactly, yes. I think, you know, a conventional plot structure, you know, everything is structured by plot. And I think plot, for me, is really the enemy of intimacy. You know, it takes something and it structures it in this false way that, you know, doesn't really relate to lived experience. And so this book really is structured by emotion. You know, each chapter is about a very particular, it sort of shows the path to a place where now I feel lost, you know, and I kind of want to investigate and interrogate that feeling of feeling lost. You know, I think in a way the book, it's about believing over and over again, you know, believing in the idea of radical queer community, believing in people and places and moments in loss and dreaming and spurning and yearning. It's about, you know, believing in the possibility for a connection that goes on and on. And it's about, you know, this sort of my political, social, sexual, emotional, ethical formations and their undoing. I know when I was writing the book, I had, you know, one friend who was reading it as an editor who said she really wanted to see the place where I moved to San Francisco and I found everything I wanted and then it all fell apart. And I said, well, but listen, actually, that never happened, you know, and it was always everything at once. And so for me, whether I call something fiction or nonfiction isn't necessarily based on whether it happened to me. You know, my two novels, Pulling Taffy and So Many Ways to Sleep Badly, most of the things in those books happened to me, but I call those books fiction because of what I focus on is not exactly what I focus on in my life. And this book is a little different because I really am kind of obsessively circling around, you know, these formations, both in terms of the micro level of, you know, how I found myself as a radical queer outsider wanting to build community and culture and love and intimacy on my own terms, and also the places of failure, the gaps, you know, in terms of where things worked and where things didn't work and where they didn't work even when I thought they were working, or looking back at it all and thinking, what the hell was that?
Well, and part of what I really appreciate about the book is the way that this everything at once plays out is that you really engage the contradictions. You talk about wanting and not wanting, the draw and the repulsion, the leaving and the staying. And in part, I wonder, you know, if we admit to living in the tensions, which much of autobiography and memoir often fails to do, can we still speak the truth in some way?
Absolutely. I think that is what the truth is. You know, the truth is those contradictions. The truth is in those gaps. You know, the truth is the places where, you know, we find ourselves over and over again thinking, you know, what the hell happened? You know, what the hell is this? And in a way, you know, I sort of believed in San Francisco over and over again. You know, San Francisco as a refuge for radical queer visions in community building, you know, as a home for the fringe, as a queer autonomous space, you know. But the rhetoric of that sort of shining, happy people, you know, we have arrived, you know, even in outsider queer spaces, often sort of camouflages violence. And for me, in not wanting to continue the violence, in wanting to challenge hierarchies, not just in straight or gay normative cultures, but also in the queer cultures that mean so much to me, You know, that means examining the contradictions. That means speaking to the tensions. That means perhaps expanding the tensions, bringing on, if there is a divide, you know, we need to investigate that. And I mean that not just in terms of larger, say, political organizing or activism, but also in our most intimate relationships, because this book, in a way, really is, for me, about the emotional intimacy, creating relationships through activism, or creating sexuality through politics, or creating politics through sexuality. So, you know, it's all of those, that kind of push and pull, and the tension between what we believe is true and what we believe. I think it's those are some of the things I wanted to investigate.
This is Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm speaking with Matilda Bernstein Sycamore, speaking Monday, April 1st, this evening, 7:30 at Powell's City of Books. That'll be downtown Portland. We're talking about your book, The End of San Francisco, which we have available for new and renewing members. You're both an author and an activist, and I wanted to talk about some of this activism. In your chapter in The End of San Francisco, What We Were Creating, and this is one of the more linear narratives that you engage in the book. You talk about your time with the activist organization Gay Shame, an organization that you founded and one that is lesser known than much of the activism that was happening in the 90s. And you say about Gay Shame that from the beginning, Gay Shame was a conscious attempt to bring politics back into the party. And, quote, we wanted to build our own culture on the ruins of the rot surrounding us. And that Gay Shame gave you hope in radical queer dreams, in creating community through critique, relationships through activism, accountability through action, and that you needed that hope. Can you talk about Gay Shame in the context of that growing mainstream movement for inclusion and assimilation?
Sure. Well, Gay Shame came about initially in New York as a once-a-year radical alternative to the consumerism of mainstream pride celebrations. And in San Francisco, starting in 2001, we made it into a direct action extravaganza, sort of dedicated to exposing hypocrisy wherever we found it, whether that be mainstream gay people arresting homeless queers for getting in the way of happy hour, or evicting long-term tenants and people with AIDS in order to get more for property values. It's sort of the contradictions of property values over people's lives and calling that community. So just putting up a sweatshop-produced nylon rainbow flag and using that to camouflage the violence underneath. And I think in the book, I'm not writing necessarily a history of Gay Shame as much as I'm sort of talking about my own emotional history. I'm sort of talking about the relationships that I formed through activism that I really, really believed in because they were based in the sort of politics that we were engaging in, politics of accountability and intimacy and negotiation, mutuality, and the idea of building trust through collective action to challenge the violence that we saw around us. I mean, Gay Shame, you know, for several years, I think, was kind of splendid in creating a kind of pageantry around activism and challenging the status quo that kind of fused the kind of the focus of, you know, taking back the streets from sort of radical anti-capitalist organizing, and also the sort of militants of a group like ACT UP, and then the pageantry of, say, for example, 1970s drag troupe the Coquettes, which was in San Francisco in the 70s. And I think for a time we really brought the pageantry into the activism and had a lot of fun and created, you know, a really exciting intervention. But ultimately, I think it failed me in the sense that the relationships I thought I was building, you know, really were not, perhaps not as true to the ideals that I thought we were engaging in. And I think that's a question that I ask, you know, over and over again in the book in a certain sense. With all different kinds of relationships. Where are the places where we hurt one another even when we think we're creating something else to replace the violence that we see around us? And I think that's a place where I don't have the answer into where is the solution and how do we create something else exactly. So I think in a way the book is sort of about this place where I feel lost, believing in the same dreams, but then at the same time wondering if they're really possible.
And really, the book is a kind of landscape, it seems, about desire and the despair, the activism, the drugs, the clubs, the music, fashion, sex, all of those things. The end of San Francisco, it's both the end of your time in that place, and it's the home that you wanted and needed, but it's also the end of that mythic place, as you say, as, quote, a refuge for queer visions outside of the status quo. Normalcy, this is really the elegy of the myth of San Francisco as much as it is for the reality. I've been speaking with Matilda Bernstein Sycamore, speaking Monday night, April 1st, that's tonight at 7:30 at Powell's City of Books, downtown Portland. Matilda, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. I really enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to seeing people this evening.
Great. Thank you.
Hey, 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 got the early Monday morning working blues. I put on my ragged, worn out working shoes. Well, the weekend was too short, but I can't choose. When the Lord made the working girl, he made the blues.
You are tuned to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I apologize if before that last interview there's a bit of dead air. We may have not got a switch turned on. You were just listening to Denise Morris talk with Matilda Bernstein Sycamore, who, as she mentioned, will be talking at Powell's tonight about her memoir, which they were talking about, The End of San Francisco. If you call in the next 11 or 10 minutes, you'll be able to, you can get a copy of that or the book that we talked about earlier today, Labor Law for the Rank and Filer. I'm now going to turn it over to Ani and Liz, who are going to tell you a bit more about how you can get a free copy of those books and more.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Joe. This is Ani. I'm still here with Liz, and we will be enticing you once more to step to your phone, pick it up, take it out of your pocket, wherever your phone might be residing, and press some numbers. Press 877-500-5266 and join KABU, your community radio station, right now. We are in our spring membership drive, and it's so important that we get your support for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We are here. The Old Moles come in weekly producing this great show, talking about really good analytical things in the community, both the economics, the working workers' perspective on things, but also I love it when the moles dive into gender dynamics and gender theory as well. And you heard that this morning, The End of San Francisco by Matilda Bernstein Sycamore. You've just heard the interview. For your $60 contribution to KABU Community Radio, you could get a copy of this book. And, you know, wouldn't that be a fabulous thing to do, Liz? I think it would be a fabulous thing to do. And people can do it by calling 877-500-5266.
Or you can go online if you are one of those wired folks, always connected to the interwebs, at kboo.fm. Look at our beautiful, amazing website and click on the Donate Now pickle jar up in the upper right-hand corner. And you can mention in the comment section that you are an Old Mole listener and supporter, and any other shows that you think are really important to keep on KABU. You know, we talk about how KABU is independent, which is true, that 83% of our funding comes from individual members and just like you, and that the rest of our funding comes from local businesses and a little bit of underwriting. You know, and all of that is true too. But what really, really matters here is that every one of you who are listening to the sound of my voice, you're part of our community, but you're not an active part of our community. You're sort of passively consuming the radio. And what we really need for you to do is go from being a consumer to a supporter. And the way you do that is by becoming a member. And it's so easy. There's so many ways to do that. But the first thing to do is pick up that phone, dial toll-free 1-877-500-KBOO. That's 500-5266. Our volunteers are standing by to explain all the different ways that you can make your membership payment. You can pay it all up front at once, a $60 membership, a $90 membership, $120, whatever value you think KBOO is worth to you that you can afford. We're not going to tell you how much to give. That's up to you to decide. But we know that you value this programming because you're listening to it right now. So, you know, put a little money where your values are. That's the important thing. 1-877-500-5266. But, you know, $90 is a lot of money to come up with all at once. Mm-hmm. So what if instead of having 90 bucks in hand, you said, you know, I'm going to do this as a monthly electronic funds transfer from my checking account, and that's just $7.50 a month. That's a couple of lattes, you know. And when we mentioned that it's the equivalent of a couple of lattes, we're not suggesting that you have to give up your couple of lattes in order to become a member. We're simply showing you that membership is something that is important to you and that it's affordable.
It's within your reach.
It's within your reach. It's part of what you would already be spending money on anyway. And if you do it through the funds transfer, it happens automatically. We don't have to send you a bill. It's safe. It's secure, and it just continues on and on, and you don't have to think about it, and the money just keeps coming in. It's a safe, secure, sustainable way to support the valuable programming that we know you care about. But we do need to hear from you. We've got just about 7 minutes left in the show, and we have about $560 left to raise. So that means if 10 of you became members at $56, we'd be done.
It could happen.
It could happen.
Let's hear easily. We have four lines open, one line engaged. Let's fill up those phone lines. Again, this morning's special offer, you can actually talk to one of our public affairs hosts, guaranteed, because they're the folks staffing the tables this morning, waiting to hear from you. Fill in, connect back.
Sorry about that.
Connect back in. And be a part of this community radio station. You are a part because you listen, you talk about the ideas that you hear here on the radio. They inform you, they inspire you. But now we need you to participate by becoming an active member, a supporter, a stakeholder in KBOO. Really get on in to your station, 877-500-5266. That $60 contribution could be done $5 a month, or on a credit card all at once, or hey, we could even send you a bill, a little return envelope. You could send it back on in with your check or money order. However you would like to do that, we
How
would
about
love
coming
for you
into
to do
the
it
station?
Now.
You could come into the station like somebody did earlier this morning. Come visit us. We're located at 20 Southeast 8th, just between Burnside and Ankeny. We're next to the Jupiter Hotel in inner Southeast Portland. This is a radical happening neighborhood here, folks. And if you come in, we will thank you in person. We'll give you a hug. We'll let you tour the station. You can meet your favorite program hosts. It's a really great way to feel connected to seeing where your money goes and what we do with it. But we need to hear from you right now. 1-877-500-5266. That's 877 toll free 500-KBOO. Ani?
And again, that $60 contribution can bring you Labor Law for the Rank and Filer. That was the book that was being talked about in the first segment of The Old Mole this morning, as Joe Clement was talking with Daniel Gross. That was a great interview with good information. You can keep that information going in this 100-page booklet about labor law that makes it accessible, that breaks it down, that you can grasp and understand so that you can, in fact, live a more empowered life. Yours for participating at KBOO at a $60 contribution level, and you can say, yeah, you want a copy of Whoa. Labor Law for the Rank and Filer. Also, a $60 minimum pledge gets you the end of San Francisco, Matilda Bernstein Sycamore, and we have only $60
this
left to raise.
This just in, we have only $60 left to raise. $60 will get you that copy of the book, The End of San Francisco. It'll get you a copy of the book, Labor Law for the Rank and Filer. It'll get you a membership in KBOO, and it'll mean we will have met our goal. Help us to do that right now, 877-500-5266, or online, kboo.fm.
Thanks, Ani and Liz. Well, I'd like to read you just a little bit from Labor Law for the Rank and Filer before we close up. It's from the very last section, a little coda that they title Another World is Possible. Stan Weir, who inspired the original version of this booklet, had a question that he used to ask students in his classes on labor education. The question was, what's the funniest thing that ever happened where you work? It was a good question. When we laughed, we were usually feeling relaxed, in control of our immediate situation. When workers laugh, it is often because they have the kind of experience discussed above in the chapter on the work to rule. Perhaps a foreman has spectacularly screwed up. Perhaps a worker, and those near him or her on the line, have won one of those small victories that help a person through the day. In recent years, students and others have repeatedly demonstrated an opposition to summit meetings of the capitalist nations, as in Seattle, Quebec City, and Genoa, Italy. In Seattle in 1999, the International Brotherhood of Teamsters and the United Steelworkers of America assisted members to attend the demonstration because they wished to protect the livelihood of workers in the United States against imports and immigrant workers from abroad. Reportedly, the unions made an effort to keep their demonstrating members separate from the more rowdy students, but many workers slipped under the arms of the marshals to join the students in direct action downtown. The motto of these students' demonstrators against corporate globalization and neoliberalism is, Another World is Possible. Another World is Possible is not only possible, but inevitable if we work hard enough for it. We encourage you to affirm it also. What would another world at work be like? That is the most important question any reader should take away from this booklet. Perhaps we already know most of the answer. The universal testimony of workers in all settings is that things go better on the night shift when there are fewer white shirts, that is, supervisors, to interfere with getting the job done right. What if there were never any white shirts to interfere? What if workers and communities ran the businesses themselves? People say, that's radicalism. Well, we've been called worse. As workers in Barcelona, Youngstown, Pittsburgh, Nicaragua, and Argentina show, when workers are given the chance, they can operate this means of production on their own. I'd like to thank Bill Resnick and Gwen Sullivan for talking about high-stakes testing, Dan Gross for talking with me about labor law for the rank and filer, and Denise Morris for talking with Matilda Bernstein Sycamore about her book, The End of San Francisco. For The Old Mole, I'm Joe Clement.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is April 1st, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. Kathleen Stevenson is the engineer today. And Kathleen Stevens is, of course, the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. The headlines, interviews, and analysis that you hear on Air Cascadia could only happen with your support. Get the facts, know your rights, take a stand. Coming up today, taking a poke at the mainstream media's standardized newswire copy. If you can tell during this broadcast where reality ends and the show begins, then we're all on the wrong track together. At one point, there will be we'll be speaking with Jeff Cohen, the co-founder of the online group RootsAction.org, regarding the campaign to award the Nobel Peace Prize to Bradley Manning. Regular listeners know that we've spoken with a number of guests on the same topic, and we're going to keep pushing ahead. Right now, though, it's the National Weather Service. It definitely seems to be on track with the April 1st spirit. The National Weather Service predicts a chance of showers today and patchy fog, otherwise mostly cloudy with a high near 65. Possible showers tonight with a low around 49. Same thing for tomorrow. Highs near 64 and overnight lows around 48. So that's obviously not much use. Let's move straight on into the alternative lunar forecast. The last quarter leaf moon in Scorpio is 20 days old, a synodic forecast. Not a good time, they say, to be sowing anything in the garden. Instead, use the time to weed and forage. It's an excellent time to start a compost heap. Biodynamically speaking, with the moon in Scorpio, it's a water sign. Good time to sow leaf plants, a sidereal outlook moon in Scorpio. And the sidereal people say that this is a good time for planting, germination, and strong, sturdy growth. So that's it for the traditional and the alternative forecast. Before we move into the stranger waters of today's programming, we're going to be speaking with Jeff Cohen. As we said, Jeff Cohen is leading this campaign to award Bradley Manning the Nobel Peace Prize. I personally cannot think of a better recipient, and certainly the image of Bradley Manning with the Nobel Peace Prize and President Barack Obama, that's really about all you need to know about where the direction the country is heading. So, yes, good morning, Jeff. I'm so happy to have you. It is sort of a bellwether, isn't it, that there's a huge, of course, there's a huge gap in the morality and the conscience and the ethics of these two American Nobel Peace Prize recipients. Manning, of course, acting purely because he knew in his heart and mind it was the right thing to do.
Right. He's not a recipient yet, but he's been nominated, and there's thousands of Americans